much. I hope you won't mind if I stay seated tonight. In deference to travel and age and so on, but it's very nice to be here with you, and greetings, direct greetings from Adyar and from the President Radha Bernier, who sent her warmest greetings. Greetings also from Pedro Oliveira, whom many of you, I think, met at last year. Now we can say last year. And who will be coming again to New Zealand and Australia later this year. So greetings from the world headquarters. We had a very splendid convention. It was a somewhat quieter convention than usual or than on many occasions. But it was a very happy and friendly convention, may I put it that way. So it's very nice to come here and be with all of you again and to share some ideas. You may wonder why such a title, Remembering the Future. So I thought I'd put it on the board with a hyphen there, Remembering the Future. Because you might say, how can we remember the future? We remember the past. And I've just mentioned the past, Adyar and the convention and the experiences. Hugh has related it of stopping in Singapore, meeting with the members of Singapore Lodge, giving a talk there on Sunday afternoon before boarding the flight that brought me on to New Zealand. But I suggest that it's a concept that we don't really think about very often, but one which really could be validated in our own experiences. If you consider the experiences, those high moments of your life, or let me put it this way, those times in your experience, in your life, when you knew that a decision had been made, even if you had not yet made it. It's a paradox, but think about it for a moment, and I'd like to discuss some of it with you and invite you to share some ideas along this line. I think it's precisely this kind of experience, when it is as though we remember tomorrow, we remember the future, that really constitutes moments when there was, in a sense, an intuition, a knowing, if you like, of things that were yet to come, a foretaste of the future, even as though you were remembering tomorrow today. So that's why I've put two lines from a poem by the author of a book that I want to quote a little bit later, and I see that Ray has it over here, The Web in the Sea by Alice Howell. This is a second book. Well, she's written a number of books, Alice Howell. She is a Jungian psychologist. But this is really a continuation of an earlier book, The Dove in the Stone. And at the beginning of each chapter, she has a number of quotations, and at the beginning of one chapter, she has a poem, the final two lines of which, like having all of never into which to set a now. Perhaps in one sense, that's what we're talking about, that we have all of never, all of time, which is timeless, into which we come with a freshness of the now, as it were. We may say, you see, that we only remember what we've already experienced, that is, what has happened. But is this really so? I'd like to provoke you into a few ideas. Because what is it to remember? What do we really mean when we say, I remember? I'm not talking about the function of memory as such, or its operation in the mind, but real remembrance, true remembrance. To remember is to put together something that has been pulled apart, to remember. To put together again the scattered fragments. In one sense, isn't that what existence is all about? What is it that we're really looking for? We can say wholeness or peace or whatever it may be, we're looking for God. I'll ask this question again at the public lecture, so I give you plenty of time to think about it. What is it we're really looking for? Would we be looking for something of that nature if we had not known it? That we are trying to remember it, to put it together again, to reconstitute it, if you like. From a theosophical point of view, we could say that since each one of us is, in essence, in our innermost nature, divine, however you want to put it, in our innermost nature, immortal, in our innermost nature, we participate in a universal consciousness. I'm so sorry. You have to excuse me, the hangover of a cold from Magyar. So we could say that at our innermost nature, there is that which is immortal, divine. Then all the experiences of all our incarnations are to remember that immortality, that divinity. So life after life, what we are doing is putting together again this picture puzzle of what constitutes the self. What is the self? But is the self simply composed of a lot of fragments, a lot of jigsaw puzzle pieces? Or is the self something else? Something entirely different than all of the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle. The pieces of the jigsaw puzzle are all the experiences of all our incarnations. But is it just at some culminating point, some moment of liberation, some moment of awakening, you know, some moment that we think we're working towards, that then the picture is complete? Is the picture composed of simply those pieces? Or is it more than that? Think about it. I'm going slowly, not simply because of my throat, but in order to have you think a little bit about this remembering. Are we putting together again that which was there in the beginning, as it were? Whatever the beginning was. Was there a beginning? Or are we remembering, putting together again, reassembling all of these experiences that will awaken us to the total picture, which is more than the sum of its parts. Since I'm suggesting that You may wish to examine this idea from the perspective of your own experiences. I thought I might share with you more something personal, but something that might make it more meaningful. But before I do that, there's a statement that appeared in an early issue of Lucifer, HPB's journal, which she began in London, which was published for a number of years. The statement is attributed to someone called Rohel, R-O-H-E-L. Now, who that was, I haven't the faintest idea. It might even have been HPB herself, because in those days, many people frequently used pseudonyms. So it could have been HPB. It could have been one of her teachers. The statement reads, "The future does not come from before to meet us, but comes streaming up from behind over our heads." Isn't that a wonderful statement? The future does not come from before to meet us, but comes streaming up from behind over our heads. In one sense, what we're talking about is involved in another concept that we find in our theosophical literature, a concept that perhaps very little attention is given to. We spend a lot of time examining what we mean by karma. And we think that's from the past. I must have done something, you know, must have done something dreadful because here this has happened to me, etc. Or I must have done something very wonderful because look what wonderful things, of course. Usually think of karma in the terms of the horrible things that happened to us. But we think of that as the past. But there is another concept that I think we need to give attention to much more. The concept of dharma. Because that's what comes streaming up over our heads from behind and overwhelms us and pulls us into the future. Dharma has been translated in many ways. Duty, you know, sort of thing. Righteousness. Religion. And it's interesting that it should be translated as religion. Religare, to bind back, to return us to our origin, which is religion. Religion is for the purpose of remembering the future. Every great religion is for the purpose, ultimately, of remembering that which is the future in full self-consciousness, full awareness. What was the original face of the self? Not made up of the faces of incarnations, but the totality. To know that in its fullness, in its wholeness. This is dharma, which comes from the root verb, if you like, three, which simply means to nurture, to hold, to contain, to permit the growth to occur. So, what is that concept that pulls us into a future which is already present, in which we set the now? Well, let me come at this in another way. I'm going to read you two rather lengthy quotations from the Secret Doctrine that I think are quite relevant to our consideration of that future which we are called upon in Theosophy to remember. This is straight Theosophy, in case you're wondering, which is all I talk about anyway, because I think Theosophy is what we're here about. That future that we are to put together in our human experience and make living. That future which we are to consciously know, because we unconsciously derived from it. Did I put it that way? Paradox, yes. Now, in speaking, therefore, of this need to remember the future, we're also concerned, I think, with the dawning of the third millennium. I was interested in your theme for this convention, Countdown 2000, something about the rest of it. Had more to it, didn't it? Mm-hmm. Accelerated opportunity. Well, we better accelerate. 6 years to go. But what's going to happen then? You see? Are we just, you know, happy to reach the year 2000? Or can we say that that is not the close of a millennium, but the opening of the third millennium? And the number three is very important. We could spend a lot of time on that too. Well, let me give you these two quotations from the Secret Doctrine. As I say, they're rather long, but I'll read them slowly. I'd like you to think about them. The first is in volume one, page 268, in case you want to check it out. Volume one, this is the original edition, of course, the original pagination. Starting upon the long journey, immaculate, descending more and more into sinful matter, and having connected himself with every atom in manifested space, the pilgrim, having struggled through and suffered in every form of life and being, is only at the bottom of the valley of matter, and half through his cycle, when he has identified himself with collective humanity. This he has made in his own image. Notice that. In order to progress upwards and homewards, the God has now to ascend the weary uphill path of the Golgotha of life. It is the martyrdom of self-conscious existence. He has to sacrifice himself to himself in order to redeem all creatures, to resurrect from the many into the one life. Then he ascends into heaven indeed, where, plunged into the incomprehensible absolute being and bliss of Parinirvana, he reigns unconditionally, and whence he will redescend again at the next coming, which one portion of humanity expects in its dead letter sense as the second advent, and the other as the last Kalki avatara. Now here, in one sense, is the whole cycle, isn't it? Do you follow that? So let us perhaps put it in this way, that coming from that unknown, which is always an X, isn't it? The unknown. There is the movement into the valley of matter, where we are now. And then comes the re-ascent to come again, and so we have that kind of experience. We may look at just one part of this, how this red works. And we may say that in the terms that Annie Besant used, for example, that this becomes then the mountain which we then are ascending in this way. Is this point the same as that point? Or is it different? Would we know that there is that kind of movement around? You see, Annie Besant, for example, the president quoted this in her presidential address, so I'll turn to that. This happened to be the centenary year of Annie Besant's, or 1993 was, the centenary year of Annie Besant's arrival in India, so a great deal of attention was given to this. And the president, in her presidential address, referred to Annie Besant's illuminating picture of humanity's evolutionary progress, the view that presents itself to someone far above the vast mass of humanity. The multitudes he sees are climbing a great mountain. That we can see. We look at that. We can see this in terms of one life, in terms of many lives, in terms of vast ages of experience, and so on. And so she quotes, "For every step forward, there is a step backward, and the people trudge round and round for millions of years in endless succession of lives, hardly advancing forward or higher. It may make weary the observer to watch this vast mass of people toiling with no result. Then the question arises why they climb so slowly. Annie Besant answers, because they see not their goal and understand not the direction in which they are traveling." And isn't that true? We wander in bypaths. Sometimes we seek shortcuts, you know. There are so many gurus and pseudo-gurus around today, you know. I was interested, I must tell you this. For those of you who've been to India, particularly, you'll be interested. I've always said that India really misses an opportunity because its chief export are gurus, you see. Well, I was down in Madras one day while I was at Adyar. I was in Madras and went to Spencer's, which some of you will remember. And there's a whole new complex, a whole new Spencer's Arcade that has arisen there. And so we went up to the first floor. And lo and behold, over in one corner, an office space with neon lights, Guru Export Incorporated. I had the vague idea what they really were involved in, but anyway. So there are gurus who will tell you to take this path or that path. Now, would we know that we are really on a journey? Some of you know, think that I have no other theme but that of a journey, but it is a journey, isn't it? If we had not some inkling of what is already at the top. This has been called by some psychologists the nostalgia for paradise that keeps us moving, as it were. And so this is what HPB is saying, you see. That we resurrect ourselves from the manyness, which is in the valley, to the perception of the oneness, which is at the peak. The other quotation that I want to read is from volume 2, page 446. Again, please remember this is the original edition, the 1979 edition, if you prefer, which is based on the original, and which has the original pagination. There, HPB says, Such is the course of nature under the sway of karmic law, of the ever-present and the ever-becoming nature. For in the words of a sage known only to a few occultists, the present is the child of the past, the future the begotten of the present. And yet, O present moment, knowest thou not that thou hast no parent, nor canst thou have a child? It's that into which we set a now. That thou art ever begetting but thyself? Before thou hast even begun to say, I am the progeny of the departed moment, the child of the past, thou hast become that past itself. Before thou utterest the last syllable, behold, thou art no more the present, but verily that future. Thus are the past, the present, and the future, the ever-living trinity in one, the Mahamaya of the absolute is. So this is what we're engaged in that sense, of a remembering of the future. In introducing this book, her latest book, The Web and the Sea, Alice Howell writes of the geometric web by which creation lifted life into being, a phrase which can remind us of the web of the universe. And this becomes a web, if you like. Pre-existent to the processes of formation. She points out that the counterpart of this geometric web lies in the seas of our personal and collective unconscious, and adds, through awareness, we can discover pre-existing patterns that can show us meaningful order in the chaos we experience at times in the world and in our personal lives. Now, it's those patterns that I'd like you to think about in your own life. Those patterns, which really, in one sense, repeat themselves again and again. Archetypal patterns. They represent the primordial geometry of life, if you like. Primordial geometry of life itself and its rhythms. And also the paradigms towards which we are moving. That goal, that nostalgia for paradise, if you like. But the archetypes, the patterns, are present in the very fiber of our being. Always developing that which we shall. Within the embryo is the total physical characteristics of the human being to be. It's known, for example, in insects which go through a complete metamorphosis, that in the embryo of the what becomes the caterpillar and ultimately the butterfly, there are what are known as imaginal discs in what will be the brain area of the new being, in the pupa stage, which determine, as it were, or trigger, I should say, trigger the next step. Does the caterpillar know it will be a butterfly? The imaginal disc is present in the pupal stage of the insect. I'm trying to put it in a number of ways for you because I really want you to think about this. We're all the time moving towards that which we are destined to become. It is built into the very fiber of our being. But we are to make it conscious. It's unconscious. The paradigm, the archetype, if you like, is unconscious. of our experiences are to make it conscious. The patterns or archetypes are present in the very structure of our being, even our physical being. But in every constituent of our human constitution. They determine that structure. They are imprinted on the web, if you like, or the very fabric of our being. And they call us into the future, and they help to give meaning and significance to every event in our lives. That's why I say if you examine the events of your incarnation, we begin to see a pattern emerging. We can say, for example, why is it that humanity develops so slowly? We learn so slowly. We move so very slowly in learning. Perhaps because we have become conditioned, can I put it this way? We've become conditioned to repeating the past, rather than remembering the future. Consider it. We've become so conditioned that we repeat the past over and over. This is what is meant, incidentally, what science is talking about today, in the paradigm shift. And I think theosophists need a really thorough paradigm shift. And we of all people should be capable of doing it. You see, what happens? We get excited because we've discovered theosophy. Yeah. We're all excited. Remember when you came on theosophy? And I'm thinking if you really came on it, not were born into it, some people sort of drift into it. You know, because their parents were theosophists, so it's the line of least resistance. But there, even for them, there comes a moment, if you are really in earnest about theosophy, when you discover it, really uncover it, really discover it, and it's yours, and it's exciting. Think about it. And you really move into a new dimension. But then you discover that your life hasn't been very much affected. Your behavior hasn't changed very much. And you go on repeating the same things out of the past, doing the same things over and over. But if theosophy, HBB makes this very clear, very few who are really theosophists, as she points out again and again, very few who really are theosophists, which is to say that they who really put into practice the ideas, really live them, really realize our unity with the whole of humanity, really know it, fully know it, and work for that ceaselessly. And say, oh yes, of course we believe in brotherhood, it's a nice first object, and why not, and it's comfortable, and so on. But how many really live it? Very interesting. I would recommend that you read the presidential address this year, because Rodham really, I think, sort of laid it on the line to us, you know, in which she, I won't take time to read it, but in which she points out what it really means to be a theosophist. What are we doing with it? And so on. If we really undergo the full paradigm shift, we are remembering the future. We're no longer repeating the past. And so the ascent up the mountain to that which we interiorly know but have forgotten, becomes swifter. You can look at the Bhagavad Gita, for example, which happens to be one of my favorite texts. And what is Arjuna's real problem? Not whether to fight or not to fight, or, you know. Arjuna's really real problem is that he's forgotten who he is. Forgetfulness, which gives rise to ignorance, non-knowing, which gives rise to confusion. We have forgotten, so we have to remember. And remember in full consciousness. We've simply forgotten who we are. And so, we do all kinds of strange things. Let me approach it from another point of view. Our third object, which is an interesting object, seems to mean a lot of things to different people, talks about the hidden potentials in the human being and unexplained laws of nature. The two are directly related, I might say. I'm not going to give you a talk on the third object, but we would not speak of hidden potentials if they were not already present in germ. So what is it to be human? What are these potentials that we are to awaken? Awakening of them is remembering the future. It's a real paradigm shift, if you like. We have forgotten. And when forgetfulness sets in, when we go to sleep, as it were, I'm not talking about at night, but we've gone to sleep because we've never really been awake as human beings. You know, we're sleepwalkers. Pretty much. Then it leads to a false identification of who we are. And we identify ourselves with office, with labels. We identify ourselves by separating ourselves. Is this brotherhood? We identify ourselves because I am national president of the society in Australia. So immediately I'm set apart. False identification. Look at our lives. Is this remembering the future, which is to recover the original face of our divinity? This is the false identification that goes on and on and on. And don't think we're exempt from it simply because we're members of the Theosophical Society, which has as its first object brotherhood. We have simply forgotten who we are. So out of that forgetfulness arises false identification. Out of false identification arises all the attractions and repulsions. Out of all the attractions and repulsions that we experience arises the grasping, the greed, the wanting to build more. All of this is there in the Gita. All of the obstructions, this is there in the Yoga Sutras. Beginning with the fact that we have forgotten. Our purpose is to remember. So the future does not come from before to meet us, but comes streaming up from behind over our heads. As I said, one can examine one's own life. One can look at experiences in retrospect that seemed to come streaming from behind and pulling us into the future, awakening. Let me be personal for a moment. As I said, I'll share a few things of my own experiences just to indicate something of what this may mean. When I was a fairly new young lecturer for the society. I visited our center on the west coast of the United States known as Crotona. Some of you have been there, some of you have heard of it, some of you know it. Beautiful place in the Ojai Valley. My first visit there was in 1945 when I was lecturing on the West Coast. That's a long time ago, because I've been lecturing for over 50 years, actually. And in the course of that tour, I visited Crotona. And I thought how wonderful it would be to live there, but of course it would never be possible, because one had to a certain amount of money, perhaps, or one had to have this, or one had to be this, and so on. And yet a seed was planted, and I knew that in the future I would be there. And of course it came about, and that is my home now, and so on. But I went there to live in 1980. My first visit to Adyar was in 1967. And I realized that this would be a place that one should work. And finally, of course, I went there to work. But it was as though the future told me I would be there. The future was already planted that I would be there. And in so many other ways, as though a seed was planted, and I was simply coming to a point, a juncture. Let me show you something else in this geometry of the web. Because this is the most basic geometry of the web. You take this out of the way. And it's something that I think we have to think about very clearly. The very basic geometry of the web begins with a line. I. But when we come to the experiences that really change us, we cross out the I. And when you cross out the I, then all things are possible. That is the basic structure of the web, isn't it? You can go on, you see, make further, you know, the web and so on. But the basic structure remains the crossing out of the I, which has to be done if we are to realize unity, to realize brotherhood. So consider your own experiences when the I was crossed out. You lived from that center, if you like, where the cross occurs, that still point, which is the now, like having all of never into which to set a now. And in that now, knowing fully, wholly, completely, that there is, as H.P.B. put it, thou art no more than the past, the present, and the future, the ever-living trinity in one, the Mahamaya, the great illusion of the threeness, of the absolute is. The absolute is at that point where the I is crossed out. That is what we are to remember. That is really all we are to remember. As Annie Besant put it in this was repeated many times through the recent convention. Life is meant for service, not for self-seeking. When we learn that, really learn it, we will have remembered the future, and we will have made the future into the present and given to the world true theosophia, that wisdom of being which can remake the world.
Thank you. thinking requires silence. Now, I don't think that I should say any more than a brief word or two, because it's then an anticlimax. And there were several things I jotted down, Joy, on the way, and we'll just perhaps mention them, because these things can be triggers for our memory. And there's this business that Charles Werner was talking about, neuro-linguistic programming,
yes.
You see, which has been going for a number of years in the States, but seems to be only creeping into New Zealand recently. Intuition of things yet to come. I like that bit, you see. Remembering tomorrow, today. And remembering that immortality, which we know we came from. There we're using the word from, meaning that it happened in the past. And we can't seem to get ourselves out of that past thinking mode. But you've given us something really to chew on here. This business about past, present and future really being all one. And the paradox is to understand that center where the two cross. Thank you very much.